you have instincts and ability that you have to balance with all the advice you get. And I would say that try to strike that balance, because the big skill about advice is knowing which to listen to and which not.
Hello, world. This is Byron Dieter, and you're listening to Cloud Giants, brought to you by Bessemer Venture Partners. This is a podcast where we talk to entrepreneurs, founders, and leaders who have built world-changing cloud companies. Today, we're here with Todd McKinnon, the CEO and co-founder of Okta, the trusted platform to secure every identity in an organization, including your workforce and customers. If you happen to work for or patron one of Okta's thousands of customers, including T-Mobile, Major League Baseball, Albertsons, and hey, Bessemer Venture Partners, then you've definitely come across Okta, since they power the single sign-on solution and much more. Today, Okta has a market cap of over $25 billion, and I hate to admit it, but Okta is part of Bessemer's anti-portfolio, which is a big mistake on my part, but more on that later. In this episode, I'm excited to get into the nitty-gritty of Okta's journey and Todd's role in bringing this company to staggering heights. So Todd, welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Byron. It's fun to be here. I'm excited for the conversation.
So let's go way back to 2008 as the starting point. The world was in the depth of the global financial crisis, yet you were fortunate enough to have a high profile and a high paying job at Salesforce. You had a young family starting at home and certainly a bright career ahead. And yet you chose to walk out the door. Take us back to the thought process back then of why you left and what compelled you to start Okta.
You know, I think for me, one of the big parts of the story was that I wanted to start a company. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I had some ideas. But at the time, between like, 1995 up to 2003, I worked at PeopleSoft, kept getting great challenging projects there, and loved that company. Went over to Salesforce, and same thing, I had a great challenge, I had a great team, the company was amazing. So I never did it, but around the time of 2008, I really was getting this desire to go, start my own company and be an entrepreneur. And you couple that with what was happening at Salesforce at the time, cloud was taking off. I mean, inside of Salesforce, you didn't have to be a genius at the time to see how different this model was, this model of cloud delivery. And I was on the engineering side, so I ran engineering. So I saw firsthand what an advantage building a cloud service was. You didn't have a bunch of different platforms to port to. You could just focus all your effort on making sure the product was easy to use, and you didn't have a lot of the dirty work of prior generations of enterprise software. And then you looked outside and you saw the success the company was having, and we were really almost running the table unopposed, in the sense that the competition was so taken off guard by this cloud delivery model and the value we could deliver and the disruptive nature of it. You could see this big technical inflection point coming. And then you looked around and you saw Amazon Web Services start to be released, and you saw Google Apps, and then it became clear that there was going to be a cloud version of everything in the stack. And that was just that kind of shift and that kind of transformation in the environment is where great companies are born, and the opportunity to create great companies comes from. And it was, at a high level, that was what really drew me to it.
So you had conviction on cloud, and we're going to dive into that. And certainly you had a number of constituents to convince, including investors, and we'll get there. But let's talk about two of the most important constituent groups early on: your family and your co-founder. I believe there is a famous PowerPoint presentation involved in the family story. So talk us through that if you can. And then I'm curious to talk a little bit about the founder dating process as well.
Yeah, it's funny because we had our first child, my wife Roxanne and I had our first child. She was 6 months old at the time. Also around the same time, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So it was a kind of a big, big scare in terms of health. But I had, I really, really wanted to go do this. And I felt like there was a big opportunity to build something game-changing, and this big shift was happening. So the second toughest thing I did was I decided to quit my job. And then the first toughest thing I did was I had to talk to my wife about it. So I distinctly remember that I came home from work one day, and she had our daughter in her arms, and I kind of put my stuff down And I looked at her, and she can just tell when I have something to tell her. And she looked at me, and she said, you know, she's like, you know, dealing with helping the baby and so forth. And she looked at me, she goes, what's going on? What's wrong? And I said, I'm going to quit my job and start a company. And literally, she'd been watching the news where Lehman Brothers was going out of business and the world economy was crashing, because she was home from work with the baby. So she was watching the news all day about the economy crashing and what a bad situation. It was the next Great Depression. And she looked at me and she said, what are you, crazy? You know, we had a quote unquote conversation about it. And then what I did was I did whatever, you know, every kind of rational, logical thinking engineer would do. I made a PowerPoint presentation that weighed out all the pros and cons. And, you know, you can still look at it. It's online, the PowerPoint presentation I wrote back then. And the title of it was Why I'm Not Crazy. And then it said, my proposal to quit my job and start a company. If you look, it's interesting, if you look back at that presentation, there is some pretty, you know, in retrospect, it looks pretty smart. There's stuff I wrote in there about, you know, this is the biggest change. Cloud computing is the biggest change I'll see in my career. All the great companies were started during a recession, Microsoft, Oracle, you know, it's a great time to start a company. And that was pretty, I would say, like forward looking and so forth. But then that was like the first two pages. And then the rest, then like the next eight pages was basically explaining how, when this didn't work out, I could go back and get a real job. And so I was kind of like CYA for the rest of the eight pages.
Awesome. Did you take the first two pages over when you were doing the co-founder recruiting, or talk us through the other side of this, where people equate the founder dynamics to a type of marriage? Explain how you and Freddie matched up on this and how you went through just the founder thinking in terms of the skills and people you wanted, and what advice do you have for other aspiring entrepreneurs out there thinking through the founding dynamics?
The first piece of advice I give is you got to quit your job. It's really, really hard to do this part-time. People try to do it. I don't think it works, or maybe it has. There's probably an exception that proves the rule, but you got to quit your job. And then the second piece of advice I give, it may sound obvious, but you got to find a founder, a co-founder, or multiple co-founders, because it's pretty hard and the odds are long and the stress is high. And, you know, you got to do it with someone you can make a great team with. And so I quit my job and then went out and started talking to people and started vetting some of the ideas I had. And I was very fortunate that my co-founder, Freddie Karest, was finishing up his MBA at the time. I kind of pitched him on this idea I had, which was a little different than what Okta turned out to be. It was more for a kind of a SaaS monitoring service. The company at the time was called Sashure. That was my great naming ability.
I remember it well. I still have the emails describing Sashure.com, which I think was described as an intelligent and integrated cloud area network.
Yes, that was there's another funny story about that. When Freddie and I started going out and pitching the idea to people, probably around the same time we were sending those emails, we pitched Mark Benioff. He listened to our whole pitch. He wasn't really excited about the idea of Sashure or monitoring performance. But the one thing that he really liked was he really loved that idea of cloud area network. He's like, that cloud area network, who thought of that? That's a good idea. I like that idea. You got to go with that cloud area network.
That's fantastic. And you did. You led with that in the early discussions. So how did that evolve? What was the pivot that caused you to, you know, name change, focus change, and yet stick with, lock arms with Freddie and say, we're going to do this. I've quit my job. We're diving in.
Freddie and I we started working together. We were very, very lucky to find each other and as a team and complimenting each other. That was pretty apparent quickly. So we were locking arms and we were going. We were doing Sashure. We were talking to people. And we had this mock-up that was we made on Balsamiq, which is like a UI mock-up tool. And we took it around and we talked to like 100 CIOs and IT people and got their thoughts. And as we got down this road of talking to people, we learned that they were interested in it, but it was kind of something that if it worked, it would really be for people that had pretty big, sophisticated IT departments. And what the other thing that came up time and time again was they had basic problems with identity. They were trying to manage their local area networks, and they had Active Directory, and they had a bunch of, you know, Windows PCs, and they had some on-premise applications, and all these cloud things were coming in there, and they couldn't do basic stuff. They couldn't log in. They couldn't have security visibility, and that was that kept coming up over and over. So very early on, we pivoted the company from being performance management to being really identity management for the cloud. And so we really had one pivot. And if you look at the next generation or the next wave of mockups we drew to pitch the identity management system, they really look like Okta today. I mean, obviously the products evolved, but the basic bones of the product. So we had one pivot, but we were fortunate that it was very early and at a very efficient time that we could pivot with pretty low cost.
Absolutely. And I want to get into both the financing strategy as well as the product strategy. But maybe I should start with a confession, which is the anti-portfolio highlight that at Bessemer, we do have this tradition of being transparent with our mistakes, not our company's mistakes. But Okta and Tesla are front and center on my page as queer misses. I think back time and time again to our discussions early on. I remember the lunch in the Bessemer conference room with you and Freddie whiteboarding out the early Sasher vision and then talking through kind of the go-to-market challenges as it evolved more into the identity side. And just the huge enthusiasm I had for the two of you as individuals, having known you guys back from the Salesforce days, as well as the vision, but just fundamentally getting hung up on the go-to-market motion and this question of, was the market ready for kind of this meta SaaS play? And you guys did an absolutely fantastic job of having that conviction and vision to force your will into the market and to tremendous success. And I think that would be the big question for you in terms of other founders today that are in a similar market. We're in a recession. We've got volatile macro environment dynamics around us. And you've got this cloud tailwind, but a lot of competitive forces and a lot of changing dynamics around financing and customer adoption and the like. And so what were your takeaways from fundraising through the global financial crisis? And what do you think is applicable to founders today that may have recessionary dynamics to fight with and yet be extremely convicted that their vision is the right one?
I remember very, very specifically, like it was yesterday, when we had a phone call and you told me that you were going to pass on the round. And the lesson I think for investors is that when you talk to entrepreneurs, remember that the conversations are very, very vivid for the entrepreneur. It's usually a big part of their future. It's something they've worked hard on. And so they're going to remember it forever. You were so straightforward and so honest with me. I really, really appreciated that. The fundraising question is a really interesting area. So don't get too hung up on dilution and ownership percentage, because it's the outcomes, even for the entrepreneurs, a lot of times are somewhat binary, in the sense of you're going to be very, very successful or you're not. And you probably should optimize on who's the best partner, raising enough money, making sure you get the right expertise versus trying to really nail down your exact dilution or ownership percentage. That's one thing. If I were to go back and tell myself 10, 12 years ago, I would give myself that advice. Really think big picture, long term, get the right partners. And I think we were able to do that by and large, but I think I spent too much time worrying about those kind of things. The other thing I would say is that, and this is more on the go-to-market side, inventing something new and defining a category is by definition is going to be hard, and it's going to be innovative, and it's going to be a little bit lonely, right? You have people questioning if it's going to work. You have investors really scrutinizing the efficiency and the payback. We had people in Okta that were board members and advisors who would say things like, you really don't know how to do marketing successfully. You really need to upgrade your game on marketing, right? You know, really kind of questioning if we knew what we were doing. And that's just kind of by definition. When you're doing something new, it's going to be lonely. But the advantages of it, if you get through it, whether that's if you invest enough money, if you innovate other ways and persevere and grind through it, then all of a sudden it flips. You go from being this kind of this lonely, struggling category creator to now all of a sudden you own the category. And then it's like all the pain is paid off, because there's paid off in the respect that now you're the de facto leader. We heard over and over again that identity isn't big enough. It's a category that there's never been a big independent company. The biggest company ever got acquired by CA. You know, it's really a part of other platforms. It's not its own platform. But then one day, you know, we woke up and all of a sudden now Microsoft launched a competing product. And so it went from being a category that wasn't interesting or big enough to build a real company to a category that was so important that the biggest software company in the world had to own it. And while that was scary, it was also liberating in the sense that now this category matters. Now, and by the way, we've been doing this for many years. We're the de facto leader. And it was like, wow, this is amazing. There's a lot of hard work grinding our way up this hill, but now it's like we're over the peak and rolling.
And the product market fit story is one of those early fundraising, you know, adages that you have to be able to validate customer adoption. And yet it wasn't really possible for you to prove out in the early days of Okta because you were launching before enterprises even knew that they were going to struggle with identity and security for their cloud apps. And so those early financings and recruiting employees and things were based very much on the strength of your team and vision over, you know, this list of 100 customers. And so for the other founders out there that are doing these more front-edge visionary things and leading markets, what are the proof points that you were tracking internally to know that it was working? And externally, what were the things you were highlighting when, you know, just revenue growth and customer growth weren't front and center as the leading metrics yet?
Well, the good news is that it's possible. It kind of evolves, right? There's these hurdles you have to get over. So in the early days of Okta, like you said, it was very much a vision. It was a theoretical thing. And we started building the product, and we took for what we were building, there was a lot of complex infrastructure. It couldn't go down. Like, it had to be very reliable, very secure, and we couldn't take it down for maintenance to patch it, right? We had to be able to deploy it, hot deployable. It had to be integrated to enough apps. So it took a while to build the first product that customers could really use. And so we went through a time when it was a couple years after we started where it was really kind of dark days for Okta, in the sense that we'd been around long enough to where we weren't the shiny new company anymore. People had expectations that we would be selling, we would have revenue traction, but we really hadn't been around long enough to have built all this stuff. So we went through the summer of 2011 was a pretty dark summer for the company. And that was really what we had to power through in terms of employee morale and missing sales targets and where are we going to be able to raise our next round. And what we really, in that time period, what we really rotated back on was really pulling the team together. And the company at the time was about 30 people probably. And we really just kind of connected with all the employees, kind of laid it all out there and said, here's the situation, here's our target, here's how we missed it, here's what we think, we don't know all the answers. Let's rally together as a team. And what we rallied around was 5 live customers. We're going to charge for the product, but forget about revenue, forget about number of, you know, funding rounds, forget about all these other startups that seem to be having flashy success in the press. 5 live customers. And then we got through that year with 5 live customers. And then the next milestone was 50 customers. And then you start to get into, okay, so now we have a couple hundred customers now, but can we actually sell this where it's efficient? And what are the efficiency metrics? So then you have to get over that hurdle. And then you have to get over the hurdle of, okay, so you can sell all these customers, but now are you getting them deployed? So what's the retention? Are these real long-term revenue customers, or is this quote unquote fake revenue that's going to churn? So then you have to get them renewed. Then a few years down the road, the big competitor comes in, because now the space is something that's been proven that's successful. So the big competitor comes and sees you, and now they're going to launch a competitor tech. Then you have to get through that. Then you have to get to multiple products, because you can't just have one product line. You have to get multiple product lines to get a company that has revenue to go public. So the good news is it's possible to do. The bad news is you have to do it over and over and over, which I guess is not bad. It kind of makes the job challenging and exciting.
There's a lot of learnings, I'm sure, for some of those dark days. And let's go back to that 2011 story, if we can. You're 3 years into launching the company, and you're wrestling with this rallying cry of just, let's just get 5 live customers and get it through. What's going through your mind at the time, and how transparent can you be with your team when you're trying to keep people inspired? You're the leader that's personally recruited probably every one of those 30 employees, and yet you've got fundamental questions of, are we going to make it through?
My approach, I had to learn this too. I mean, my first reaction was, you know, kind of keep it all closed. You know, I'm supposed to be the master. I'm in charge. I'm the master executor, visionary, like I should have all the answers. My first reaction was like, I'm going to do this. Because you got to remember, my experience was I'd come off 2 or 3 years before that. I was leading a team of like 300 people in a big established company. So I did have all the answers, right? I had to go from this, in that tough year, I had to go from that leader to a leader that was really transparent and open and motivated the team and led in a different way. And it was really effective. It makes sense in retrospect. The team that joined that company at that time, they were kind of in for a little bumpiness, right? They knew they were joining a small company. They knew there was going to be a lot of unknowns. So the fact that I really opened up and let them in worked out really well. The other thing I would say about it too is that there's opening up and letting, kind of being transparent and working with the team to find a solution. And then there's like your personal psychology and your personal freaking yourself out. That really is something that you can't share too much with the team, because there's a thin line between being transparent, open, and collaborative on problems and solutions and directions forward. But you don't want to imply to the team that your psychological state is something that is going to lead you to have undue kind of fear and paranoia about the future, because you at some level you have to be a foundation of stability. The other big lesson that is probably helpful for people listening too is that it's crazy how much the inertia and the culture is set in the first year or so. And I think our culture today has a big aspect of openness and transparency that really traces its roots back to that summer of 2011.
And so moving into your first CEO job, you openly admit that's something you had to learn and adapt. There's probably other parts where you'd never run a go-to-market organization. And so coming from the engineering side, where you probably had this innate understanding of how to measure product and manage technical resources, what was it like for you to then manage the go-to-market and finance and operations part of the business? And what advice do you have for founders out there that may come from those technical roots, trying to then become also, if not masters of those other functions, at least extremely competent managers so that they could hire and manage great people?
There's going to be areas where you have no idea. Like for me, go-to-market, marketing, I had no idea. You know, it wasn't like engineering product where it's in my career. So there's going to be areas where you have big gaps. And it's a balance between, you know, some people might give advice and they might say like, oh, you know, you know what you don't know. Just get the right people, get advisors to then tell you what to do. You have to balance that, but you also have to have your own backbone. You have instincts and ability that you have to balance with all the advice you get. And I would say that try to strike that balance, because the big skill about advice is knowing which to listen to and which not.
And another important area is strategy, where you've got to weigh in. And I want to go back to a comment you made on Microsoft, where the role of co-opetition is always delicate in building a long-term platform. And Microsoft is a major Okta competitor, and yet you always maintain the importance of having all of your products work with the Microsoft stack. Why do you do that, and why not be more aggressive with them?
Okta is, from the beginning, one of our hallmarks is we're integrated over 6,500 applications and services. We're the most integrated identity platform out there. And that really came from the first five customers, back to getting the first five customers live, get five customers live. What we'd ask them is like, what do you have? What technology do you have? And they'd give us our list and we'd go build integrations to them. And we kept doing that. We got 50 customers, and then the integration network started to grow, and then we made the ability for people to build on top of it and outsource, you know, have partners and vendors do it. And so we're very driven by this concept of just deeply culturally, this concept of connected to everything. And what happened in 2012 and 13 is Office 365 started taking off. And the best thing that ever happened to our company was Microsoft went to the world and said, put your email in the cloud. And once you put your email in the cloud, all these things cascade. Your firewall doesn't work very well for security. You have people working from anywhere. You have to be able to make sure you have the identity managed. And so it was the best thing that ever happened to us. So I think that the platform and working with different vendors is something that's very deeply ingrained in Okta. The competitive part of Microsoft is they do compete with us, but our competition with Microsoft or with big infrastructure service platforms or application platforms, it's very distinct, right? It's like identity is its own platform. We're the leader. We connect to anything. We're not trying to get you into Salesforce apps or Amazon infrastructure specifically or Azure. We're trying to get you into everything. You can kind of compete with people on features, functions, and price or all these different metrics. But for long-term success, you have to pick a competitive dimension that you can own in the sense of almost like at a philosophical level. Because when you go to the market and you say, we have these features better than Microsoft, or we have these features better than this other company, that can be changed or made up over time. But at like a philosophical level, Microsoft is not going to want to connect you to every other vendor where we can credibly claim that. So that's how we think about both the importance of enabling other applications and services to connect to our platform and at a big picture, the competitive landscape.
So you were open in talking about some of those near-death moments where you sat there and said, I'm not sure we're going to make it through. What about the other side of that? When was the first time you really thought, wow, not only are we going to make it, but this thing could be huge?
It was October of 31st, it's the end of the quarter of 2011, that's when our quarter ends. The target for that quarter was, it was like 280,000 ARR, ACV. And we did like 320,000. So we beat our number by, what is that, like 40,000 ARR. And that, I mean, it felt like
top of the world.
I got won an Olympic gold medal, won the lottery, and discovered the new world all in one day. I remember the next milestone after that was the next year where we had $1 million bookings month. So it was like we booked $1 million of order in a month. And that was amazing. And then I think, you know, as strangely as it sounds, I definitely think when Microsoft launched a competing product, don't get me wrong, it was scary and daunting to have such a major competitor, but it was very validating. Because I could tell that it was going to shift from being, this is not a big market, this is not a big opportunity, to this is like a potential to create a game-changing company.
Let's jump ahead then from 2011 to, let's jump ahead to April 7th, 2017, where Okta had their big day. What were you thinking about the morning of the IPO, and what's going through your mind as the stock starts trading?
One of my favorite times in my life. It was very, very, very satisfying, very enjoyable. So the roadshow is, people always say it's pretty tiring. So you're pretty burnt out by the end of it. 2 days of flying all over the place and having back-to-back-to-back meetings. And I remember the morning of the IPO, I had to be up super early because I had to be on Squawk Box. I think it was like 6 a.m. Eastern, which is like 3 a.m. Pacific. So I basically remember just trying to get out of bed and get moving in the morning of. It was great. I went on Squawk Box, and then we also got to, I had my family there, my parents, my sisters, my kids, my wife.
It's one of those few tangible moments in life where you can share it with family, and it really is a physical event that everyone can celebrate with you.
Yeah, it was cool. My parents were blown away. They were like, oh my God, look at this. This is amazing.
So this cloud thing may be real that Todd's been chasing.
Exactly. But I think that I'll tell you a funny story. So you go through the roadshow and you have the pricing the end of the day before, and the deal, by the time the morning that when it trades, the deal's kind of done. It's off to the banks to kind of do it all. And so you kind of do the photo ops and you open the market, you ring the bell. That's all very satisfying. And then about two and a half hours later, the stock is going to start trading, right? They've kind of made the market and got the orders in, the bids and the allocations, and they're going to actually have it trade. And so we go through all this, and then we're standing next to the guy at NASDAQ who's going to start to kind of call the open price and see that it starts trading. And I remember that he's telling me, he's like, all right, okay, I think it's about to go. This is what the price is going to be. It's all set up. Got the orders. And I remember thinking to myself two thoughts. One thought was, It was like when I took my daughter for the first time to the playground. I let her go in the playground, which is about 3 years old. And I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen to her? She's going to be all right. She's going to get run over by a kid. And it felt the same way. I was like, it's going to trade. Oh my, what's going to happen? Is it going to, like, I literally thought, I said, what if no one buys it? What if it goes to zero? What if the price is zero? Maybe they're irrational thoughts, but luckily people bought it and it traded pretty well. So,
well, as the story goes, it didn't go to zero. There were some buyers that showed up. I think the market cap on the closing day was $2.14 billion, which by all accounts is a home run success and a mic drop moment. But what's even more surprising is over the 8 years that you built this $2 billion in market value, and yet today the company's valued at $25 billion. 10 times that value creation was built in only 3 years. Literally $23 billion of market value. How do you process that? What have you done in the last 3 years that's been so magical? Or was it that it was massively undervalued through the years? Or was it this compounding effect? How could you possibly have built $21 billion of market value so quickly? And just talk us through what's happened.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are very important. One is that over the last 3 years, the world is become more and more clear to the world that SaaS and cloud are the future. And that's very important to our success. So everyone is pretty universally in agreement that things delivered as cloud services are the future, and there's going to be really big, substantial platforms that are going to create a lot of this kind of future cash flows far, far into the future. And cloud companies are going to do that. That's one thing. The second thing is that investors, once they get that macro high-level conviction of the cloud, then the next thing is they have to see you as one of those major players. A lot of things are important to that, but one of the main things is that for you to consistently deliver what you say you're going to deliver. And I think that's what we've been able to do. And this has started even before we're public. When we were 2 years before we went public, we started meeting with public market investors and telling our story and getting to know them. And when we went public, you could see those same investors taking out their notebooks from those meetings over the previous 2 years and looking at what we told them and the numbers and the milestones and the roadmap and what we delivered. So we started building an incredible amount of trust and confidence in the investors. And then doing that we just had our 13th earning call as a public company. Doing that for 13 quarters in a row builds up a lot of credibility, so they can see you as being one of those really important players, and what they've over the previous 3 years become to have a lot of conviction. It's going to be a massive, massive part of the economy.
And Todd, you've always impressed me with your leadership in general, but I also want to comment on how you're using the platform for broader social leadership. And I should note that we're recording this episode during a global health crisis and a social crisis in America. And you've been extremely active socially as a CEO by taking the 1% pledge for Okta, as a board member at Family House. And most recently, you were one of the first CEOs to publish a statement in support of the Black community. And I'm going to read it here for our listeners because I think it's powerful. And then I'd ask you to comment on what prompted you to write it. Why, as a CEO, did you feel like you needed to weigh in on these important social issues? And here's the statement. Racism of every kind is unconscionable. The images and news stories we are seeing about the treatment of Black people in America today are incredibly tragic. I stand with my Black colleagues at Okta and the entire community as we work together for a more just and kind society. And then there's a series of threads in terms of some things you're doing specifically and actions. But what prompted you to write that and give you the confidence to be one of the first CEOs to take this very public stand?
First of all, I am extremely, extremely fortunate and extremely lucky personally in my own life. If you just look at the family I have, the environment I was born into, you could really start to count up the ways. For example, being born in the Bay Area in the 70s and wanting to get into tech and having access to the tech industry. And so I consider myself extremely, extremely fortunate and lucky. And I think that as I have some bit of success, I really feel an obligation to try to give back or use that success in a positive way. And so that's really driven a lot of my personal things I've done to give back. You mentioned Family House. There's others. And also really the Pledge 1% and the philanthropic program at Okta, which is called Okta for Good. It's been really important to me that as we benefit from all this environment we're in, we also try to give back and to the degree we can use our time and our talent and our money to try to make the communities we live in, the society we live in, a better place. So that's the high level philosophy there. on the, you know, this, the tweet you read, I think that we have to make sure in a time of, there's so much uncertainty right now and frustration and passion. And I think leaders can help set the, kind of help set the foundation for the debate we're having or for the environment we're living in. And I think what I wanted to say in that tweet is that everyone feels very strongly, let's set the foundation. The foundation is that, you know, racism of any kind is unconscionable, as the tweet said. And we stand, I stand in full support of the, you know, the black, my black colleagues at Okta and the community in general to really be clear that, you know, racism is unacceptable, and we're going to do whatever we can to support the community and to move toward a world where we don't have to deal with this kind of racism, these kind of issues. It's not easy. It's a daunting thing, and it's complicated. And I'm going to be the first person to say that I have a lot of listening to do. Like, I don't have the answers. I'm open to the conversation about the answers. You know, I'm confident that we can come together and make some progress.
Well, on behalf of the entire community, I thank you for your leadership here. And what's most notable about it is that this was one of many statements and actions that you've done through the years to support a number of social and philanthropic causes and missions. And you've made this very much a part of your core leadership philosophy and part of Okta's culture. And I absolutely believe that a large part of your success is how openly you've embraced the connection between corporate and community. And employees know that about you and know that about the company. And I suspect they feel good logging in every day as an Okta employee, knowing that they're helping to do broader good. And a lot of people have since followed your leadership on this issue and many others. And so, absolutely. Thank you and appreciate what you've done in terms of using this wonderful platform you've created to advance a number of important causes more broadly.
I appreciate that.
Okay, so we'll transition here to the rapid fire. Every time I ask my guests a series of rapid fire questions, and I want you to give quick, you know, short 5-second, 10-second answers. First thing that pops in your mind. Are you ready?
I love it.
All righty, let's go. I know you're a fitness guru and big into exercise. So what's your go-to workout during these shelter-in-place days?
My go-to workout is 10 rounds per time, 3 ring muscle-ups, 4 handstand push-ups.
Wow. You're in rarefied air there. I thought you were going to say Peloton. No handstand push-ups here, but I'm impressed. What's the go-to must-read book for a new founder out there?
4 Steps to the Epiphany by Stephen Blank.
What websites do you visit daily, and what information sources do you consume on a regular basis?
Chatechery, spend a lot of time on Twitter, and TechMeme.
What cloud product was most critical in building your business, obviously outside of Okta?
AWS.
What's one thing you wish you did more of when you were a first-time entrepreneur?
Spent more time building the initial team, coordination on recruiting.
Where do you think you will personally be 10 years from today?
I think about this a lot, and it's definitely going to be working at Okta. That'd be a great milestone. 21 years. I'd be legally able to drink.
There's a gold watch involved. That would be fantastic. We'll do the reunion comeback podcast then. I look forward to it. All righty. Well, then, the last question, since this won't apply to you, but it will apply to other founders out there. If you were going to found another company next year, what would you do differently this time around? What's the key advice for the new founder out there?
I would try to do network effects earlier, virality earlier. Easier said than done.
Exactly. The R-naught of enterprise product, we all pursue it. Todd, awesome to have you on the show and to spend time with you. It's always a pleasure. Immense appreciation for your time and respect for what you've accomplished.
Thanks, Byron.
And that's our show. A huge thank you to Todd McKinnon for coming on to Cloud Giants and offering your insights and wisdom. For founders and entrepreneurs looking for more resources on the topics we covered today, be sure to check out all of our resources at Bessemer by going to bvp.com/cloud. And if you could do me a favor, I do appreciate it if you can rate and review the podcast on Apple or wherever you're listening, as this does help others find the show. Or better yet, share the episode with social media and send it to a fellow entrepreneur. We're living in a cloud-first world, and these are the stories from top CEOs to help tomorrow's leaders. So until next time, I'm Byron Dieter, your host of Cloud Giants.